From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Corlott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz joins me for a conversation about Russian airstrikes in Syria and whether Russia is asserting itself in global security politics.
Putin is really trying to show the world that they are a great power, or were a great power, obviously, during the Cold War. Here we are some 25 years later, and that they should be on equal footing with the United States.
Then I'll talk with Paco de Onís and Pamela Yates. They use their documentaries to raise awareness and create social change, like their films chronicling Guatemala's genocide.
Film has the power to create empathy in people, and people can connect to the stories.
And we also like to think that our films help grow that movement.
Filmmaking and human rights activism, coming up after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlott. Rebecca Cruz, let's talk about Russia. It has launched airstrikes in Syria. These airstrikes were approved by Parliament. This is the same situation we saw many months ago in Ukraine when they authorized military force in Ukraine. This obviously comes on the heels of our conversation last week when we talked about the Russian president and the U.S. president meeting and discussing Syria in particular. So what is going on here exactly? I mean, are we really starting to see Russia kind of branch out, reach out, extend its influence? What are we to make of these new airstrikes?
Well, there were some very interesting visuals this week as President Putin and President Obama met. They did have a meeting. They came out and clearly are not on the same page in regards to Syria, and certainly weren't on the same page in regards to Ukraine before that. But it does really seem like Putin is really trying to show the world that they are a partner, that they continue to be a great power, or were a great power, obviously, during the Cold War. Here we are some 20, 25 years later, and that they should be on equal terms, equal footing with the United States. And that seems to be what's going on here. What is also interesting, though, is while Putin is trying to do this posturing, or at least this is what we're assuming that he's doing, the public opinion polling in Russia for the actions in Syria is actually pretty poor. The public is not necessarily in favor of direct military action, with actually 69% of them in a recent poll saying that they are opposed to this.
Which is quite different than the action in Ukraine, right? But that was because they had interest in Ukraine. You know, the strategic interest in Ukraine on its border, the importance of Crimea, the importance of eastern Ukraine, lots of Russians there. Whereas they're probably asking themselves, where's our interest in Syria? And are we really interested? And what I think the big question is Russia really interested in trying to solve a problem in Syria? Or is it, as you said, just posturing and demonstrating that they're still a power to be reckoned with?
I think it's mostly the latter. There are some strategic interests in Syria. They do have a base there that they're trying to hold on to. They have been a supporter of the Assad regime and trying to show that they can be a loyal supporter. But you're absolutely right. Ukraine is a much closer situation. We can talk about the strategy there, but it really, I think, comes down to identity and being able to kind of have that neighbor, perhaps even that buffer that we've talked about before, and kind of a protection of Russia proper.
Well, of course, we understand that after the action in Ukraine, the United States kind of marginalized Russia. A lot of the Western countries wouldn't deal with Russia, the sanctions, all of that. But, you know, there was some thinking that with this recent meeting that there was going to be some attempt to perhaps re-engage with Russia and try to cooperate in the region. But I'm thinking after this, perhaps there will be further marginalization. But who knows? And the final question is where is Russia going to go next? Where will we find the Russian Air Force, you know, dropping bombs next?
Well, I really don't know the answer to that. I think they're going to continue to try to engage in Europe, perhaps somehow get involved in this refugee situation. I'm not sure if they're going to try to have influence there. The situation in Ukraine, though the violence hasn't ended, it does look like it's winding down to some degree. Perhaps the peace settlement that was signed last year, some discussion of that actually coming to fruition. So as that's winding down, we are seeing them gearing up in Syria, and perhaps they'll be looking elsewhere. Europe is probably where they're going to be looking, but it's hard to say right now.
Russia continues to be a dilemma, and the fact that nobody really did anything about Ukraine is perhaps empowering them a little bit here. I mean, I think we have to ask ourselves that question. All right. Well, thank you so much, Rebecca, once again, for discussing an interesting international issue this week. Thanks.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation and answer any questions you might have. You can leave your comments on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU and at Suzek Werlot, or on our website, kgou.org. While you're there, you can also download any of our past segments or full episodes. There are also instructions to subscribe to our podcast so you can listen on demand on your desktop, tablet, or mobile device. Next, I'll talk with directors Paco de Onís and Pamela Yates about their activism and documentary filmmaking. I'm Suzek Werlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Werlot. My guests this half hour are documentary filmmakers Pamela Yates and Paco de Onís. They started their own production company called Skylight Pictures as a form of international activism. Their goal is to raise awareness of human rights and social justice issues and use that understanding to facilitate social change. Pamela Yates and Paco de Onís, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, the two of you are documentary filmmakers, but not just to make film. You are activists as well. Tell us a little bit about how your interest in social justice has led you to making film, and how does that film really help you to express the kinds of subjects and issues that are important from a social justice perspective? Pamela, would you like to start?
Sure. Well, I'm from the Appalachian Mountains in Pennsylvania, a town of about 2,000 people. It was an Irish-American enclave, and one of the currencies in trade in the town was storytelling. People were really great storytellers. They were poor, but culturally they were very rich. And I like to think that as a filmmaker, I'm carrying on that tradition of storytelling. I think because of the extremes of wealth and poverty in the area of the country I grew up in, I was always interested in righting that kind of historical wrong. I figured that in the United States, the richest country in the world, it doesn't have to be that way. And I think that really formed me, and it really shaped the kinds of stories that I wanted to tell as a human rights defender and as an artist.
So Paco, what about you? What is your background and how do you come to this area?
Well, my background is I grew up in Latin America, in Argentina and Brazil, under military dictatorships. And my father was a journalist. He is a journalist. He's retired now. But he reported on all those events that were happening around us. And in my lifetime, I've seen the whole Latin American continent shift over from military dictatorships to democracies. And that's been a big source of inspiration for me. And I think it's a great social justice, human rights story, how the human rights movement contributed to this change of a whole continent. And so now I think with film, we can tell these stories, human rights stories, that and film has the power to create empathy in people, and people can connect to the stories. So that's one big reason that I think film is very effective.
You know, we really came of age as filmmakers in parallel with the growth of the human rights movement worldwide. And that movement has given us stories to tell. There have been incredible leaders of that movement who are the protagonists in our film. And we also like to think that our films help grow that movement. So we've created a virtuous cycle between the film and human rights activism.
Let's talk about region for a second. I mean, Paco, you mentioned that you grew up in Latin America, and the two of you have made film around the world. Of course, you're probably best known for your film in Latin America. So what is it that draws you there? I mean, obviously, your historical background, where you come from. But Pamela, how did you end up in Latin America? And in particular, I think the film that you for which you were awarded a Guggenheim and which has gotten a lot of publicity, and we'll talk specifically about that in a minute, is Granito, which was filmed in Guatemala.
I was working as a sound recordist. I really wanted to be a film director, but I didn't know how I was going to do that. And I was working as a sound recordist on other people's films, watching directors work in Central America during the wars in the early 1980s. It was then that I heard about this hidden war that was happening in Guatemala. And I knew that the Guatemalan journalists who are trying to cover the war themselves were being censored or were being killed. And so I thought this was a very important story to tell. I had read a book called Bitter Fruit, which was about the CIA's overthrow in 1954 of the democratically elected government of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala. And it made me so mad that the United States had been on the wrong side of history in ushering in these military dictatorships that I felt as an American citizen I wanted to go there, investigate the story, and tell the world what was happening in Guatemala. So that was the genesis.
That's Pamela Yates, and this half hour I'm talking with her and her filmmaking partner, Paco Deonis. We'll hear more of our conversation about documentaries as a form of activism right after a break. I'm Suzette Rolat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Rolat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Documentary filmmakers Pamela Yates and Paco Deonis are with me in the studio today, and we're talking about how they use film as a form of activism to create social change. For you, Paco, working in Guatemala, I mean, this brings you to perhaps your connection to Oklahoma and your work with Clyde Snow, who was a forensic anthropologist and did work in this region. How did that come to be, and how is it that you then came to support a lot of his work? And another way in which you can promote human rights is to uncover scientifically what's going on in these areas, right? So you're doing kind of the film work, and he's doing the work on the ground. How did that work out, that partnership?
Yeah, well, several years before we started filming Granito, I was working on a short film, and I met Clyde Snow in Guatemala. We actually met there, prearranged, because we were going to film an exhumation with him. And that led me to meet the person who heads the Guatemalan forensic anthropology team. His name is Freddy Pecciarelli. So that was a very great meeting. We remained friends after that. And then when we went to start filming Granito, Freddy starting a huge exhumation in Guatemala City, and it was because of Clyde that we knew him, and he gave us access to film, and that became a very important part of the film Granito. But it was really Clyde's impact, not just in Guatemala but all over Latin America and the world, I would say, in teaching a whole generation of young people to be forensic anthropologists who are now doing that work. So his impact was huge.
Well, and the work being done there, of course, was to note the war crimes that were being committed and to document them. But there was also an attempt to use this information, obviously, at a tribunal. And so can we talk a little bit about how that relates to perhaps one of your other films that came before the Granito film, The Reckoning, which is about the battle for the International Criminal Court? Because this notion of perhaps you're out documenting that these things are happening. Lawyers are working on the legal side of things. People like Clyde Snow, forensic anthropologists, and others that are working to provide the scientific evidence. All of this, presumably, to hold somebody accountable for what has happened in these cases, to highlight them to where they don't happen again, to prevent them in the future. So how does all of this come together so that we can hold these criminals accountable? And how is it that the criminal court actually contributes to that?
Well, the International Criminal Court is the first independent international court to hold individuals accountable for genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. And the way we tried to tell the story in The Reckoning was we tried to really make the audience feel like they were looking over the shoulder of the chief prosecutor of the court. Where were the worst egregious cases in the world? What was the evidence that was available? Who were the alleged perpetrators? And how were they going to gather the evidence and bring those perpetrators to The Hague and to trial? How could a tiny court in The Hague actually change the paradigm of world justice? And The Reckoning is really the story of the first six tumultuous years of the International Criminal Court, as all of us tried to figure out how can we perfect international justice. These kinds of stories are really fascinating to tell filmically because there are so many people contributing and there are so many fascinating stories. Sometimes it's a little daunting about how to thread all these stories together and make it coherent and not overload the audience with too much information. But I feel like since we take a long time to make our films, we really don't release the films until we get it right. And getting it right means taking the audience on a fascinating journey of how the evidence is compiled and how justice is ultimately served.
So as far as the criminal court goes, I mean, this particular film, what would you say, what was the conclusion that you drew? I mean, this is, as you said, following, you know, the chief prosecutor around the world, multiple continents, multiple cases, I presume, that he's working. How did you ultimately conclude that, you know, or what did you conclude, I guess, in terms of the utility of the ICC? Is it just facing too many challenges? Is it going to be successful? Is it? I mean, it's had very few convictions. So in terms of its historical record, it's young. But is it eventually going to get where it needs to go and going to do the job it's intended to do, which is to hold people accountable and to prevent these things from happening?
We try to leave it really open-ended at the end of the film. In other words, we take the audience on this journey. We show them that the court is really beleaguered. But ultimately, we have a point of view. And our point of view is that the court is a very good thing and that there should be a universal acceptance of the court. The United States is not a member of the International Criminal Court, and we really should be. And so we really put it back on the audience, you know, that we have the responsibility to make this the world court that it should be and not a moribund institution like other international institutions may have become. And, you know, that's part of being an activist and that's part of being a human rights defender. You really want to engage the audience so that at the end of the film they feel both an emotional engagement, but also that they want to do something or they want to learn more. Or they want to get more involved. It's up to them. But I think if you make a good film, people are much more apt to do that.
And I think that also the court, it depends on political will. Well, just to back up a little bit, the court came about really through activism of civil society organizations from around the world. I mean, they really drove the creation of this court. It's a treaty-based court, so countries only are members if they want to be, if their legislature approves it. So right now there are 123 out of 193 countries in the world that are members, including all of Europe and Latin America, Canada, about 30 African countries. So there are a lot of countries that have bought in. But for the court to be effective, it's going to take time. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, when new jurisdictions are created, like here in the U.S. and in the Wild West back in the 1800s, you know, it took a while for legal jurisdiction to take hold and be respected and be effective. So I think that it's a baby court, you know, it's just starting out. So it's facing some big Goliaths out there, like the UN Security Council.
Well, so back to Latin America then, and your most recent film, Disruption, takes a little bit of a different turn. Tell us a little bit about this film as it focuses on strategies for financial inclusion, particularly for women, and doing so in perhaps a different way. It's helping women to save money as opposed to lending them money, right? So micro-lending is kind of one of the most recent kind of buzz terms used, but, you know, programs used to help bring people out of poverty. But this is a very different program. So why focus on this, and how does it help empower women in a Latin American community?
Well, I think that the idea behind the program that we see in Disruption is precisely that women who are living in a state of marginalization because of poverty, who receive cash transfers from the government, this group of activists, economist activists that we met and are in the film, they thought, let's teach these women with that cash flow that they're getting how to save and how to manage their money rather than offer them loans, which perhaps they're not ready to really take on and manage. So it's really a financial education and even a financial citizenship program. And the idea also is that it unlocks this huge potential in a country's economy and society, which is the women who aren't really participating financially. So by bringing millions of women in Brazil, there are 15 million women who receive these cash transfers. And now there's a whole huge financial education program being launched this year in Brazil for those 15 million women.
It's really a film about economic human rights. Because of all the films that we've made, of all the films about war and about crimes against humanity, at the basis of all of this is poverty and extreme inequality. So what if you could imagine a different world, a world where the avenue for social change was through women? and through women who traditionally have been left out of the financial system. So this is a film about possible financial citizenship as a way of reducing inequality. And it's also, we thought it was something, some really amazing and innovative ideas, social entrepreneurial ideas coming from the Global South that the Global North could have much to learn from.
And so far, the evidence would suggest that this is gaining ground and that this is a better approach.
Yeah, but the question our film asks is it can it be taken to scale? Because I think the measure of its success is if it will be taken to scale. And if it will be taken to scale, then a real disruption could occur.
So I'm going to end by coming back to this issue of documentary film and the ways in which we can learn about these things through film. In some way, I feel like, you know, I'm a documentary film buff, but some ways I'm like, I'm sympathetic to these ideas. And so I see these films because I'm drawn to them. To what extent do you feel that your film is reaching an audience that perhaps wouldn't necessarily be supportive of these things right off the bat? Do you feel that this is the best avenue for that? How do you get to those who really need to be changed by these ideas?
You tell a good story. I mean, ultimately, the first and foremost responsibility, I think, to reach a general audience, which is our audience, we want to reach people that don't know anything about Guatemala, that don't know that the sole genocide of the Americas in the 20th century against indigenous people happened in Guatemala. But they're going to be drawn into it because it's a really good story. And for each of the stories we tell, we try to tease out the universal values. Yes, it's a story about Guatemala. Yes, it's a story about Brazil. But actually, it's a story about all of us and how all of us can participate and add our granito, our tiny grain of sand, for positive social change.
Yeah, it's a constant challenge also how to get these stories out there. But we, you know, we use some of the usual channels like television. Our films air on PBS. But then we do a lot of big outreach work through the web, through grassroots screenings. And we try to reach audiences that perhaps haven't really been exposed to this. And then I think that with a film like Disruption, for example, that's a film that would appeal to people of across the political spectrum because, for one, you're ending poverty. It's about not having dependency on a government program. You know, the whole idea behind it is for them to learn how to manage their finances and eventually get off the program. So,
and you get to meet great women protagonists.
You meet great women.
Well, Pamela and Paco, thank you so much for being here today and sharing your story about the work that you do. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Suzette.
You've been listening to my conversation with filmmakers and activists Pamela Yates and Paco de Onís about using documentary film to advance causes for social justice. You can watch the trailer of their most recent film, Disruption, and some of the other documentaries we talked about on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaboration between the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies and KGOU. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, and Ivy Dyson writes our web content. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Corlott.